afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the Joint Committee on Student Success Subcommittee on Revenue. It's March 7th. We have an informational meeting this evening. Mr. Alanak.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So tonight, the discussion is going to turn a little bit toward the potential administration of either of the taxes. So just as a review, the committee has heard from three different stakeholder groups about different potential revenue options in terms of reaching a $1 billion goal or whatever the dollar goal is. And tonight, the Department of Revenue is going to talk about two of those three options, a commercial activities tax or a business activities tax. The third option, as the committee may recall, is basically doubling down on the existing infrastructure. So it's just changes to the current corporate income tax and so forth. So it's not a new area. So the focus for tonight, DOR looked at these taxes and is taking a first stab at their initial thoughts. It's probably the best way to think about it, is an initial thoughts on what administering either one of these two taxes would look like.
Thank you. Department of Revenue.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue, and I've brought with me today Katie Lawley, our Business Division Administrator, to go over kind of the vision that you have, that you folks have been talking about related to these two taxes. As Chris just mentioned, we're going to be talking about the commercial activities tax, and the, which is based on gross receipts and really nothing deducted from it, and the business activities tax, where you start with gross receipts and take some modifications for labor, capital, cost of goods sold, that kind of thing. Because there isn't any bill language yet, we are basing our presentation on what you folks have been talking about, as well as our sister states in Michigan and Ohio, and what they've learned and shared with us as we've talked with them. Sorry, I didn't turn that slide over quick enough. So the assumptions on this slide really are about both of the for the CAT and the BAT, as they would apply to both. Katie will talk about some of the differences between the administration of the two, but our implementation phase would be staged depending on the type of work that needs to be done. And it will also depend on the complexity and size of the tax program. So just for your information, generally we need up to about 12 months to implement something from the effective date of a tax program for it to become operative, depending on, of course, the complexity of it. So the dates that you choose in this bill will become important for our ability to comply with it. And then additionally, the complexity of the tax of the program itself will affect how long it takes us to implement. As you add complexity in the form of deductions or credits or exemptions and that kind of thing, that just requires us to do more instructions, more forms, and reaching out and outreach, education, that kind of stuff. So just to be aware of that. We based on what is happening in other states, we have learned that all of these taxes would apply to all entity types, so whether they're individuals, partners, S-corps, or C-corporations, and all types of businesses, depending on the policy choices you make relating to their size or the type of business, whether they're a farm or rental, that kind of thing. We also talk about one of the things that we should make you aware of is because in other states, they mostly have sales taxes. They do use that information from those sources to help with their enforcement. And they've shared with us that it would be important if you do something like this in Oregon, that it would be important to and helpful for our enforcement efforts if we had a registration component in there so that businesses registered ahead of time so we would know that they're in place. We, for purposes of this presentation, we have assumed that it would be a separate program in addition to all of our current existing programs. So if the policy choice was to replace or eliminate another program, we would have a transition plan in place, of course, to put the, you know, phase out the old program and bring in the new one over a period of years. But we did not talk about the cost of that in this presentation because we wanted to make sure you got a more clear picture of what the administration of these two types of taxes would be in a more pure light. Some of the things we've learned from other states is that how, depending on how you structure the final tax, is it's very important that the language you choose is not based on income tax law or income tax history or federal tax law, just to make sure that the to avoid potential litigation relating to potentially double taxation. And then also just to draw attention to a gross receipts tax in particular, that you would have to consider some sort of an exclusion for the new vehicle privilege tax, because that is also a gross receipts tax. So we also assume in our in what we've done to do this implementation that because of the types of income that comes in from insurance companies and financials, that they would be not necessarily excluded from these tax systems, but their tax base might be a little bit different because the income is for financial institutions is from equity capital, and for insurers it's from receipts from premiums. So even if they're included in the tax, they would be treated maybe separately on a separate schedule or some way to deal with the calculation of what those receipts are. They have been historically treated differently under our current income tax programs because of that reason, and then also in other states. Sometimes they use a different rate, a different calculation method, or both. But in any case, we can address those inherent differences in either of those programs. Also, our assumption is that the implementation costs, the startup costs, will be incurred before receipts come in. So we would need to continue to work with, we would want to work with LFO to make sure that we have some source of funding to do that work before receipts come in. So that's pretty typical when you start up a new program. Also, in our preliminary analysis, just for the simplicity's sake, we have not included any exemptions, exclusions, deductions, modifications, or tiered rates, that kind of thing, just to show a true picture of the two, or the multiple rates like they have in the Washington B&O tax. So just a refresher, I know that you guys have talked about that. Inclusion of any of those would, you know, decrease the tax base. It could increase complexity. So that would have an effect on whatever costs we have related to compliance. And it could go up or down depending on the policy choices that you make. So we're happy to work with you on making those decisions and help you with that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wanted to, it sounded like you're about to ready to move on to the next one. And I just wanted to ask if you could, thank you, first of all, both of you for being here. Could you just talk briefly about the registration component? I get that I think what you said was in a sales tax state, you kind of have a sense of what all the businesses are because they're paying sales tax. And how is that different? I mean, we do have voluntary compliance, as we know. And so how would something like this be different than the voluntary compliance that we already, I mean, right now we don't know if we're getting all the returns from C-Corps and sole props or whatever that we need. So I guess, could you just expand on that briefly?
Madam Chair, Co-Chair, and Representative Smith-Warner, I believe, in my understanding is the difference is that it's based on gross receipts as opposed to net income. And so it's just a mechanism to help track the receipts. And that's where the other states say that most of their leads come from is from their sales tax registrations.
Okay, thanks.
I'm going to follow up on the question about registration. How would does that mean you would anticipate needing to stand up a system called like a registration system? And the reason I'm asking that is, what kind of information do we already have from the Corporations Division at the Secretary of State? And I'm always interested in making sure that Oregonians don't have to do something two or three times when we already have access to the information.
And Madam Co-Chair, we actually have a partnership in our withholding tax program with the Secretary of State for our centralized business registry. We would assume that we would do something like that in the online, in Revenue Online as well. But I think that we could coordinate with our partners, our sister agency, to coordinate that information like we do in our withholding tax program. It just makes sense to try and do that if we can.
And that was the right response.
Okay, well, good. Okay, so I think that that was all I have on this slide. I think I'm going to hand it over to Katie to talk about the specific assumptions for each of the two different kinds of taxes.
Okay. Good evening, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Katie Lawley, the Business Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Revenue. So on this slide, you'll see some continued assumptions. Again, these are for both the CAT and the BAT, and as Deanna said, based mostly on models that we have been working with Ohio and Michigan on, based on their tax systems or previous. Most of these assumptions represent policy choices that would be made by the legislature, but we've chosen to start with the very simple, basic kind of a tax system. The first assumption is that all entities would be using a calendar year period. Again, this is just a simpler thing, and it follows along with what other states have done. And then for the department to implement any new tax program, additional staff would be needed. Based on the estimated size of this program for the number of taxpayers and the revenue raised, we believe this will best be served by the creation of a new section within our structure. Work will need to begin early in the biennium, depending, I guess, on when it starts. But assuming it's starting this biennium, we would need to start as soon as possible. However, it would take some time to hire and train new staff. Most of the new positions would be needed to be permanent for both the startup and the ongoing implementation. However, several of those would be limited duration just to address the upfront work, the increase in work. Implementing a new program, any new program really, but these in particular impacts many areas of our agency. Therefore, additional staff would be needed in all areas of administration, such as policy, enforcement, appeals, processing, call center, information technology systems, collections management, and probably many others. Again, with any new program, there will be extensive work to configure all of our systems, both the front-end intake systems as well as the back-end processing system, in order to enable us to receive and process returns and payments. Depending on timing of the new system, some of this work may be done within existing timelines. For instance, if we have a project going on to implement some of our front-end processing systems, we might be able to just kind of tag into that, and that would help decrease the cost, depending on the timing. New administrative rules would be required for any of these new programs. Even a simple tax needs rules to further clarify the provisions of the tax and details such as penalty waivers, for example. In addition, the tax types being discussed are new and unfamiliar to most taxpayers. Therefore, both tax types would require extensive rule writing to ensure that people, taxpayers, the public are fully aware of the new laws. In addition to administrative guidance, new tax forms, vouchers, web content, and instructions must be developed. Again, the policy choices that the legislature will make will directly impact the number of forms and the extent of the instructions. And then finally, because this is a new program, we envision doing a good amount of outreach and education. As we did with the statewide transit tax, we would plan to send a letter to each business operating in Oregon. According to our records, this is approximately 450,000 businesses. Now, not all of those would be necessarily subject to this tax, but we're not going to know that. Their revenues are going to change from year to year, et cetera. So we would want to just kind of over-communicate in the initial phases because this is prudent. The first letter would just be informational and point taxpayers in the right direction in order for them to get additional information. We also plan on creating a public awareness campaign that may include our website for sure, could be some TV or radio, social media, newspapers, etc. Once the details of the new laws are known, we would definitely right-size our approach to outreach and education. Okay, on the next slide, we'll talk about...
Since you're changing slides, mm-hmm. I have a question about outreach and education. You mentioned letters, social media, perhaps radio or TV or print. What about professional organizations?
Thank you for that. Yes, we definitely have liaison groups existing with both attorneys, CPAs, and other tax professionals. We meet with them on a fairly regular basis, as well as have listserv emails that go out to them. And so we would definitely be targeting that audience as well.
Thank you.
The next slide, I'll get more into the specifics of the CAT, or the commercial activities tax.
Oh, yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Can we go back a slide, please? I really want to have everyone on this committee underline two words, broad assumptions. What's been shared with us is most definitely a good overview, what would be required. But when we start digging down deep into this, the administration of what we're talking about is going to be extensive. You know, we're going to want to know, does it fit within its GenTech system? We want to know within the existing staff, what is their capacity? What is the morale of the staff to undertake this? And so at some point in time, as we proceed forward, we may want to hear from Mr. John Borden at LFO to get his take on issues within the department and how what we're looking at doing would blend in with existing activities.
Thank you.
So I understand, obviously, that you've been learning about these different approaches, the CAT and the BAT. So this is really just a refresher. My intent really here tonight is to stay in line with what you've already been hearing about and to add in some information related to administration of each of these taxes. Commercial activity tax, we've been looking at a model similar to the one that Ohio has in place, has a broad base as the tax is imposed on gross receipts with no or few exclusions or modifications. The tax is also applied across all business NAD types. Because of the broad base, the tax rate can be lower and still produce the desired revenue results. Something I'd like to point out for this one is that exclusions, exemptions, modifications, multiple tax rates would increase the complexity of administration and especially the ongoing costs of compliance activities. The increase in compliance cost, as noted in our administration, or is similar to our administration of our current income taxes where there are these type of things. It leads to harder to understand or compute taxes. When the taxes are hard to understand, voluntary compliance can fall off. A simple, easy to calculate tax results in a higher level of voluntary compliance. Increased rule writing, again, the more complexity, the more areas we would find potentially where we would need to clarify things by rule, so that would increase there, and then as the taxes get more complex, there are more areas that we might need to audit or do compliance work on. And then obviously from audits would come potential for litigation, and so again, just those costs could increase as well. In Ohio, the next bullet there, minimum tax. In Ohio, there is a minimum tax that is paid at the beginning of the tax year of between $150 and $2,600, depending on the business's expected gross receipts. This minimum tax is then applied against the tax due for those companies that have a quarterly filing requirement. Having all businesses pay a minimum tax has the effect of getting money in the door sooner. However, from an administration standpoint, the simpler method would be to set a dollar amount of minimum tax for smaller businesses with only the larger businesses filing and paying on a quarterly basis. This would reduce the number of returns and payments that we would need to process. Ohio has both annual and quarterly returns with gross receipts thresholds for businesses to determine their filing frequency. Large businesses, those with gross receipts over $1 million, are required to file and pay quarterly. All quarterly filing is done through the state's online filing portal. Any online filing obviously decreases costs, decreases paper. This also reduces administration. Well, I just said that. Small businesses, which are have gross receipts under $1 million, would be filing annually. They would have the option to file online or in paper. And they would be paying the minimum tax again. Then they would only need to file again if their gross receipts do end up going over that threshold. We would allow for those kind of changes. Okay. Next one is the business activities tax, or BAT. This is similar to Michigan's former business activities tax. It does have a narrower tax base because, again, the calculation starts with gross receipts, but then each subtract out some input costs, such as purchases from other firms or cost of goods sold. There are many possible variations with a BAT tax because of the policy choices involved with what inputs to allow as a modification against gross receipts. For purposes of this discussion, we're following along with basically, I think, what you've been talking about, what Chris has been presenting about. The other thing that is a little bit more complicated with this tax is that it starts at the nationwide level for larger businesses and then would be apportioned down to get just to the Oregon activities. Apportionment and modifications, again, are examples of policy choices that would potentially increase complexity of administration for us as well as for taxpayers. Also, exclusions of certain product types could increase administrative complexity because there could be definitions that may be interpreted differently. This could also lead to somewhat higher costs for compliance activities such as audit and appeals down the road. Again, I'll reiterate for this, it's very much the same here with these increased costs. Taxes that are harder to understand or harder to compute or have more layers to them, the voluntary compliance activities we see falling off. A simple, easy to calculate tax does result in a higher level of voluntary compliance. The increased rule writing that I mentioned previously applies here. Audits, again, the more inputs that we have onto the tax form, the more area there is to audit, and then obviously litigation costs. Okay, as with the CAT tax, the BAT can also have a single tax rate. The rate is generally slightly higher due to the fact that the base is narrower. Again, having multiple rates would increase complexity. When everyone applies the same rate to all activities, makes it easier for everyone to understand and compute. When additional tax rates, exemptions, or modifications are added, the tax can become more resource intensive, in part because there is more opportunity for differing interpretations. Michigan's form of the BAT did not impose a minimum tax. All the taxes were paid either quarterly with quarterly payments or annually with the tax return for the smaller taxpayers. This is very similar to our income tax programs. All businesses would file annually on a calendar year basis. So this means basically, like I said, with the income tax, the first filings would be due in April of the year following the first year of the tax was in effect. And again, the same assumptions apply in terms of large businesses. Those with gross receipts over $1 million would be required to make quarterly estimated payments. Everyone else would pay just one time with the return. And again, that $1 million threshold is really, again, that's a policy choice for you all. And then the next.
Before you turn from that slide, I have a question. For both of these taxes, you have been very clear about when we start to make it more complex, all those other things flow from that. More administrative rules, compliance may drop off because it's harder to understand, and so forth. With this one, you talked about apportionment. Mm-hmm. Is the apportionment characteristic of that tax, is that pretty straightforward, or is it ever kind of squishy and causing a problem for figuring out? Do you anticipate that factor it is not a big deal, or it might be a little tricky?
Madam Co-Chair, well, again, it depends on the actual bill language. If you know, you were to implement something very similar or the same as our current corporate or our income tax apportionment. That would at least give us that to learn from. So I think that would make it easier for us to administer. But apportionment is a very complex area, and it is a state-only issue. So it's not one that we can say rely on the Internal Revenue Service for help on. It's something that we really have to tackle and work with other states on.
Thank you.
So this slide here is really just a side-by-side comparison of all the information that I've already talked about, so I won't go through it in detail. The comparisons here, I just want to make sure, are between each other. So they're between the CAT and the BAT. They're not between the CAT or the BAT and any other type of tax. So for instance, tax rates show lower for a CAT type tax and somewhat higher for a BAT tax, even though the rate can still be quite a bit lower when you're comparing it to an income tax. The one I will talk a little bit about is administrative costs. So actual administrative costs do depend on the complexity. Our analysis included here are for simple, very simple, without modifications or exemptions for the CAT and the BAT. Again, the CAT being very fairly straightforward, leading to hopefully increased voluntary compliance, simpler audits, less collection activity, and somewhat the less, or the opposite being true, the more complexities that are added. And just before I turn this back over to Deanna, just a final reminder that we've made these assumptions based on the other state programs and what we've been learning so far, and keeping with the very simple basic calculations. Most of these assumptions, though, will change or are possible to change based on the policy choices that you all are considering.
Yes, Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize if I missed this. Now, on two sides, it said no on the minimum tax for the BAT. Is that the assumption you're making from other states that have used it because they do not have one? Because I believe in the presentation that we heard, I think there was one in it. But maybe I'm remembering that wrong. Anybody else? Chris, do you remember?
I'm not recalling specifically, but I can look it up.
So that's just to check it. That's your understanding of in other places that there has not been a minimum.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith-Warner, that's based on the way that Michigan had their business activity tax.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So our final slide lays out the relative administrative costs for each tax type. The comparison, again, is based on our assumptions that we've presented today, which are broad and are wildly changeable because you guys have these policy choices you have to make because we don't have bill language. And I don't want to leave here with you thinking we can't administer one or the other. We can administer both of them depending on what you guys want to do. And the differences really between the two are marginal in either direction. While some of them are lower and higher, they really are marginal. And when taken together as a package, the estimated net cost is also marginal. So depending on the actual language that you come up with and the policy choices you make, we obviously can make a better estimate over time, especially related to the administrative costs and potential complexity to the voluntary compliance system, as well as our ability to enforce it. But I'm going to cover the different program areas high level to explain why we think the work is going to be higher or lower or maybe the same in different areas. So our policy function, that's the program area in our department where we do all the startup for new legislation. The transit tax was an example. We do that in our policy work. It involves administrative rule writing, forms and instruction design and development, developing our web content, working with software vendors to make sure their forms align with our systems, system testing, overall project management, communication outreach like Katie talked about, and as well as at the end of the day, handling some taxpayer appeals later in the process. So there's a lot of work that happens in our policy function. So while both these taxes have different nuances, work in this functional area required under a BAT is going to be marginally greater than that under a CAT because of the additional complexity related to the cost, the exclusions, the subtractions that you would be taking from the gross receipts.
For outreach and education, we think that for both tax types, there's going to need a high level of education because, like Katie said, they're relatively unknown in Oregon. But because the BAT has more complex computations, it would require marginally more education levels out there. We expect that there would probably be more internal work related to people calling in and questions about that. With a complex computation, just there's going to be more questions for staff. For forms, we think that they're going to be pretty close to the same number of forms, depending, it doesn't really matter which one you would choose there. And of course, depending on the assumptions that you guys make when you actually choose your policies. But we think that pretty similar, although the instructions maybe for the BAT might be longer or bigger, more complex because of the additional subtractions. For our systems, the system configuration, either way, it's going to be a pretty extensive amount of work to do that, but our system can do it for our return processing systems. As well, in our return processing area, there's going to be increased activities related to, you know, mail, payment and return processing, imaging returns, in correspondence, and just basic account maintenance. Now, in this area, the CAT has got a little bit more expense because of the quarterly filing return requirement, right? There's going to be four returns and that many more payments every year to process. However, that does help with compliance, as we can get on the enforcement sooner with the CAT than with an annual return. Our enforcement efforts in the CAT will be slightly lower just because not as much to audit. If there's no subtractions or modifications, then you're just looking at receipts as opposed to looking at receipts as well as deductions. But both of them, so we think that both of them, since they're new to Oregon, will require a pretty substantial amount of audit audit trainings, new staff, that kind of thing. Because, again, I've already mentioned, because the CAT has a quarterly filing requirement, we think that the enforcement efforts will probably be a little bit better. We learned with the recent implementation of the transit tax program that we could just get right on the filing enforcement and get people out there, and subsequent returns have been, the compliance rate has been much higher in the subsequent quarters than it had been in other programs.
Excuse me, we have a question for you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. The returns. I don't think Nevada does quarterly returns.
Nevada?
Without, could it be done annualized or
certainly, Mr. Co-Chair, it could be, or Madam Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, it could be done on an annual basis. I believe that is one of the things that for the CAT is, believe that's what this slide will indicate, right? That they can do the annual return for the CAT as well if you choose to. It does slow down it lowers the cost, of course,
and
if you do.
Because in the next slide up, when you were going through higher or lower,
Right. And we're just basing this on Ohio again and Michigan. So if you choose other options, if you change it to an annual filing requirement, then of course it would have less returns to process. You'd want to consider maybe estimated tax payments in that case to get your revenues coming in. So you'd still have that. But yeah, you can choose however you want. This is just based on Ohio. Mm-hmm. And then finally, I think we have collections, of course, I talked about that. So really, I guess that's it. That's really all we have to share. It really just depends on how you guys, the policy choices you want to make as you move through this, whether we can administer both of them, either one of them. And really the difference is when you take them holistically between the two packages, that in Ohio versus Michigan, there are marginal differences in the ability for us to administer.
Very clear. I appreciate it. Senator Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in your conversations with Michigan and Ohio, did they mention the cost the taxpayer was going to incur as a result of this tax?
I think that Madam Co-Chair and Senator Bentz, I'll follow up on that. I don't know. I'll have to check with the people I've actually talked to them. Because I didn't have those conversations. But I'll find out for you.
Hello. Right. So this is a great presentation showing us our side of the equation. It would be great help to know the other. Just as a wild guess, Chair Haas showed us a one-page sheet earlier in this exercise, but I forgot which tax it was for, and I don't know what kind of tax either that we're going to be doing. But I guess the best answer is to ask them. So, yeah, thank you.
Well, Chair Senator Bentz, if I could just follow up slightly on that. I don't know that, I mean, we will definitely follow up on that. I don't know that as a revenue agency that we would have information about those costs, so I don't know that Michigan or Ohio would. But I think when we're talking about our administration and if it's more complex for us, I think that generally holds true for a taxpayer as well. You know, thinking about a very simple income tax return, many people can file those by themselves, but as they add layers of complexity, even just itemized deductions or a small business, then maybe they have to go see a tax preparer or have somebody assist them with that.
Thank you. This was a very helpful presentation, but I would like to push you one step further and ask you which of these two taxes would be easier for the department to administer.
Mr. Chair and Madam Co-Chair, I really think that we can do either one of them. We'd like to work with you to see what the what your options are that you're choosing and help guide you in the ways to make it easier to administer as you progress through this process. But we can really do either one of them.
Okay.
Oh, Madam Chair, thank you. To follow up on that, I assume that in answer to his question, you would give, it would be easier to administer whatever tax requires the fewest exemptions, modifications, exceptions, et cetera. Is that correct?
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Burdick, anything that eases complexity is certainly easier for taxpayers to comply with and for us to administer.
So to follow up, so if you had a tax scheme that had to have a whole bunch of exclusions, exemptions, and modifying mm-hmm. provisions, that would be a factor in ease of administration.
And Madam Co-Chair and Senator Burdick, that's correct.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Bentz.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So the In the little bit of research I've done on these taxes, I did go look at the Ohio and some of the Michigan materials, and it looked as though, because of the disproportionate impact of the tax, and that was one of the reasons they discontinued the use of these devices years ago, and now they're coming back into favor. But the reason for many of the adjustments is to try to, in some fashion, take into account the disproportionate impacts of the tax. And that would complicate matters significantly. So in an effort to try to make the thing more fair in its incidence, we would find ourselves being asked to create those kinds of exemptions in the long laundry list that we've seen of different rates. What would that do to your analysis? In other words, if you've been here for all of the meetings, and you've seen, I think it was Nevada, but I can't remember, each area had its own little rate. What would that do?
I think obviously the system needs to reflect fairness. I mean, that's one of the policy goals that the legislature has, at least in the income tax system. And to that end, we would want to help you craft that as we can to help come up with those solutions that end up being as easy to administer and accomplish the goals of fairness and equity as we possibly can. Without bill language, just theoretically, it's hard to weigh in on that at this point.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just want to reiterate earlier comments. One, I think the department's more than capable of implementing the system. They do a great job, but I don't want to make light of what it's going to take. The department just a few years ago was struggling with what LFO calls key benchmarks, and they struggled with everything from timeliness to satisfaction of the taxpayer, to responsiveness. And so, again, I believe the department is more than capable of doing it. But very similar to the Oregon Health Authority years ago, I don't think this committee should take light of what it truly is going to take to transition tax policy, especially as we keep Oregonians in mind. And so I want to get that on the record. As a person who knows that department from a legislative perspective of chairing their budget for the last 6 years, we need to not make light of the broad assumptions it's going to take.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments regarding this presentation? Thank you both.
Thanks
for the presentation. Mr. Alanak, there are some new materials that have been posted for public review. They were posted even before the meeting. Could you explain to the committee what you've posted?
Sure, Madam Chair, members of the committee, to kind of round out the discussion, there are two simulations loaded up into OTEM simulations loaded up related to the business activities tax. So this complements the discussion that began on Tuesday regarding, and these are on Tuesday, they were SIM 1 and SIM 1L. These are SIM 2 and SIM 2L. The only difference is that instead of the commercial activities tax, it's the business activity tax. I do have them labeled as preliminary. We are still working through some technical modeling issues, but I think these are getting pretty close. And just broadly speaking, the results are fairly similar between the two taxes. So without going into too much detail, unless you'd like me to go further, that is what those two products are. So now we have out there, we have OTIM runs for both of these taxes, at least a starting point. As the discussions move on over the next few weeks, I'm sure there will be more simulations as parameters change and assumptions and so forth. But this is a starting point, so
okay.
That's out there for the public.
Thank you. Senator S.
I guess I would ask Chris if there was any similarities or dissimilarities or things to note here. I see some of the same sort of negatives. But I'm just wondering if what we're seeing here.
So broadly speaking, the top part of the output, if you will, these high level metrics, employment change, personal income change, there are kind of two ways to compare this. Within each one of those, you can compare 1 to 1L and 2 to 2L. But if you want to compare between the two tax programs, you want to compare 1 to 2 and 1L to 2L.
Right.
So taxpayers want to keep that in mind, or stakeholders want to keep that in mind. And the L is, again, this productivity factor that gets turned on. But broadly speaking, so just I happen to have SIM 2 pulled up. All of the positives and negatives, nominal personal income is down about 0.09%. Employment is down minus 0.28%. All of those pluses and minuses are pretty similar between the two runs. The one difference that we have is on the bar chart at the bottom and the total real disposable household income. The negatives are less under the VAT than they are under the commercial activities tax. So that's showing that the bottom line impact to households appears to be less on the value added tax side than on the commercial activities tax side. And this is one where we're having a lot of internal discussions about interpreting those, and without getting into all the detail, one of the challenges we're working with is the notion of this U.S. value-added tax base. And OTIM was really built with Oregon in mind. And with this tax, it's kind of thrown us a curve with starting with this U.S. value-added tax base and then apportioning that down to Oregon. So that's what we've been working through on the best way to model that aspect. So that's the biggest difference that I've seen. There are little differences. The numbers aren't exactly the same, but they're fairly similar, except for this impact on real disposable household income.
I noticed the job, the employment number is still down here, even in the L version. What could be tweaked to the VAT proposal? What kinds of things could we do to gin that number up?
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question, and that's kind of on the top of my list as to figure out and really get into the guts of the model as to what is driving that. And so we're having some more conversations about how that's being modeled and seeing if that's, if it's being modeled in the best way that it should be modeled. So that that has been persistently it's not as responsive as some of the other metrics. Mm-hmm. So that's raising some questions that we're looking at.
Thank you. Other questions or comments about this new material? There's one other piece of business. I'd like us to hear from the co-chair of the full committee, Joint Committee on Student Success, on our schedule next week.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colleagues, I just wanted to let you know that the plan for next week is that the full Joint Committee on Student Success will be meeting during the Tuesday and Thursday evening time slots. So Senators Bence and Burdick, you seem to be off the hook. You're welcome. We are going to be, the other two subcommittees have gone through their work and are going to be reporting back to the full committee. That's the subcommittee on early learning, as well as the subcommittee on accountability and transparency, and they're going to bring some recommendations back to the full committee. This committee, while I would not say we have completed our work, I also don't believe we have, due to the slightly different nature also, we do not quite have a recommendation ready to the bring to the full committee, but certainly the materials that we've gotten so far, the simulations and some of the other outlines are going to continue to inform it going forward. So we will be meeting. I'm not sure if this sub will meet next week at another time, given all of our committee schedules. It would be challenging to find another time at which we could meet, but we will have more meetings going forward as we work to put together a proposal to bring to that full committee sooner rather than later as well.
Thank you. So the message is stay tuned. We might find a workable meeting time next week, or we might not meet again until the week after that.
That is correct.
Okay. Any other business for the committee? We are adjourned.